You are Locked On Knicks, your daily podcast on the New York Knicks. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Shot blocked. Porzingis with his fourth projection. Courtney Lee for three.
Beasley lines up. Ntilikina.
What he does is contagious. He comes in, touches.
And across the lane. Baker launches. Jack to Porzingis. Fires up the ball.
Welcome, everybody, to Locked On Knicks, the podcast that's in the 99th percentile of having that song Zoot Suit Riot stuck in my head. It's been like 3 days, and I can't get it out. I'm sorry, I gotta do it to you. Zoot Suit Riot, Riot, something, something, bottle of beer. I'm your host, James Marcina, a.k.a. Emmanuel, why you gotta be so rude, eh? And this is episode 255. On today's sode, we're joined by Drew Steele, editor-in-chief of Holyfield. And we talk a lot about Emmanuel Mudiay. We break down what he was doing well, what he was doing poorly in Denver. We touch on all kinds of stuff. His defense and different play types, his shot at the rim and from beyond the arc, his on-off numbers. We talk about the history of late bloomers in the NBA. And then we make a very interesting comparison between Emmanuel Mudiay and a character from a very popular movie. I think you guys are going to love the discussion that I just finished up with Drew. I knew I had a great time talking to him. All right, enough about the show. Let's start the show. Hit it, Marv!
Yes!
Drew, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, James.
How you doing today, bud?
Getting by.
Is there anything you want to talk about? Are you, like, sad, or?
No, not really. It's just one of those, you know, Mondays.
Yeah, okay. If you, just so you know, if you ever have any, like, relationship issues, not money problems, but anything, like, personal, you can come to me, and we can talk it out. But
that works. I'll call into the show next time.
All right, yeah, live.
Live.
I'm here for you. I want to be here for all my guests. That's, you know, just part of what we do. It's part of what makes Locked On Knicks special. What I want to talk about with you today, other than any potential relationship issues you might be having, is you wrote a piece on Emmanuel Mudiay, published it. I read it. I found it very interesting, focusing largely on his time in Denver. And now that he just played his first game for the Knicks in a loss on Sunday night and is set to play his second game Monday night against Philadelphia, it's perfect timing to break down what he's done in the past as we look toward the future. So I'm wondering if you could just kind of take us through some of your findings that you wrote about, some of the things that he struggled with. If you have anything you want to start with, that's fine. Otherwise, I can suggest a subtopic on Emmanuel Mudiay.
Oh, no, we can get it. It was actually funny that I'm like, I was doing the research after the trade, and then the game comes on Sunday, and he plays quite well. And then I'm like, oh, no, like, I'm going to publish something rather negative, like right after a good game. But even in the game, a lot of the stuff he did in Denver did show up, you know, in the Knicks game, and largely on the defensive end. He is not that good a defender. And it's really interesting because it's not just like one defensive metric. So it's not like just defensive RPM that rates him terribly. It's like defensive RPM, you know, team plus my, you know, on off data, the play type data on NBA.com and like, and the film. It's like, it's just this encompassing thing. And you're just like, well, these are really bad defensive metrics. And then it just really questions, you're like, can he ever actually improve?
I mean, it's interesting that you brought up like his, like, you know, I don't know if you used the word thrilling to describe his debut, but his, you know, successful debut. And there were definitely things to like about him. But when I was watching it, like you said, like, I did recognize a lot of the things that people have complained about. And so, like, while on some level, because the Knicks have been such a point guard desert for, you know, our entire lives and beyond, it's like refreshing to see some of the things, you know, he can do that some Knicks point guards haven't been great at. When I watched that game, I still saw all the warning signs that are like, all right, well, he still isn't any better at this aspect of his game, like defense being one of them in particular. I mean, the way he gets over picks is just, I mean, is atrocious fair? I'm not trying to be a dick, but like, he seems like he's...
It's interesting because I don't know if atrocious is the right word. Like, I don't know if that's too strong, but when you're 98 out of 98 out of, you know, all point guards with a negative 3.61 defensive RPM, like, that's atrocious.
And it's well below average, right?
Like, is that fair? I'd say it's just maybe a little below average, but it hits you because he tries to go over every single screen. Like, there's no going under. He goes over every single one. Then he gets hit every single time. And then he doesn't always fight through it either. Like, he'll get hit, and then it's, oh, I'm just going to go with the switch. You get him on an island, Kyle. And it's, and then you have, like, Kyle with Oladipo, like, you know, isolated. That's a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you just really kind of saw the horrors defensively because he was asked to guard Victor Oladipo the entire game. And
which is a tough cover for anyone this year.
It's fair because he's been amazing.
Yeah.
But it was like every single play. Like, he was just getting burned. And it's definitely difficult.
And he does something that also, like, drives me crazy that a lot of the Knicks do. You pointed it out in your article. I forget who he was defending against. It was out on the three-point line. I want to say it was the Raptors, but I'm not sure. And he got switched. And he could have easily switched back, but he let the big who was switched onto his man kind of get, like, stuck on an island. And I think, or maybe it was against, like, the Nets and Dinwiddie.
Yeah, it was against the Net. It was Dinwiddie. And the way the Raptors were covering, like, you know, how they were handling pick and roll was kind of interesting in the first place because they seemed, like, just kind of watching Raptors film, they did a lot of switching. So I don't know if it was actually the scheme or Moody himself because, you know, with defense, it's kind of tricky if you're not in the practice and
yes,
looking at them. But the one player you're pointing out is he actually goes to get over the screen. He jumps it on the right, but, you know, but he overcommits. So then, you know, then when he goes to the side and then he leaves for readout on an island. And he just kind of – and he had all the time and like, everything there. Then we just drains a three right in front of Fareed. And it's like, that didn't have to happen. Like, you could have forced Dinwiddie to make a play. And they didn't. They just gave him a wide-open shot. Dinwiddie's been great all year.
That's one of those things that always drives me nuts because it's kind of impossible to know on some level if it's the scheme or the individual defender, like, without holding your phone in front of the coach and being like, this play – like, what happened here? Like, should he have switched back? But it seems to me the Knicks, like I said, like, they do it a lot. Like, especially, like, Jack and Kristaps will, like, switch, which is, like, it can't be your scheme to, like, gladly give up that switch. It's always, like, such a massive mismatch. And then a lot of times it seems like they have opportunity to switch back, and they just don't. And it, like, drives me insane. I don't know. Sorry, I'm getting into general.
Yeah, no, that's, you know, it's what... The Knicks' defensive scheme is also a whole other level of, you know, insanity on its own, right? Because, right, you have the players doing these weird things with switches, and then a lot of times they're just packing the paint to prevent the drive. And then when you're packing the paint to prevent the drive, you're leaving, you know, shooters open in the corner. And then it's an easy dish out to the corner for the opponent, and then you have the entire defense scrambling. Yes. Like, the Knicks, like, defense is so focused on, all right, we have to prevent the layup. But they don't have to really focus that hard because they have Porzingis and then even coming in like O'Quinn, who's been a really good defensive player this year as well, defending the rim. So it's like they don't have to pack the paint in that much, but yet they do. And it's a weird thing.
It's almost like they have got this old school mantra of like, well, first stop layups and then like we'll figure it out. But you can't do that in 2018. Like, you've got to be figuring out both the 3-point line and the rim at once. Like, it can't be like a first this then that, because then you're just gonna get buried. But I'd like to talk a little bit more about Moutier. Some other things that you've found from his time in Denver. Obviously, there's been a lot made of his shot, his shooting form. And it's interesting because this year he's shooting 80% from the free throw line, which is something that a lot of people say is like a good portend for things to come, especially when it comes to, like, you know, a lot of times young players shoot really well from the free throw line but not from beyond the arc, and they say, well, that, you know, shows me that they're decent shooters. They have a chance to extend their range.
And this year he's also gotten better from beyond the arc. I think he's about 37% overall. But still famously a very poor finisher at the rim, even though a lot of his game is driving. So I'm just kind of wondering what you make of that.
Well, the three-point shooting has been, it's like kind of like the one silver lining about Moutier that kind of gives hope to, you know, like a lot of Knicks fans and stuff. Like, not only is he young, like, he's at, there's actually an aspect of his game that he has improved, and that is his shooting. And you kind of, and it's kind of, it's been progressive too. And he's been really good in catch and shoot situations. Mm-hmm. And that's mainly because he actually has his feet set and his body square and everything. Because there's a lot of times if he's not doing that, he does this weird thing with the bottom of his leg that I've noticed kind of just like watching these highlights, where most of his misses come from, he throws his right leg forward and then his left leg back. So he's like shooting not in balance. And most of the time those are misses. And then you watch his makes and it's, you know, his feet are perfectly set and you're like, okay, like you can see it. Like there's something there. Like he still has to improve, but there's, you know, good room for improvement. Like he can, he just has to work on setting his feet more.
That, and yeah, that form sticks out immediately because, you know, I haven't been watching like a lot of tape on Moutier until he was traded to the Knicks. And then you watch a couple and you're like, oh, like it's not subtle.
No, it's not subtle at all.
Yeah. It's almost like the Jason Kidd leg slash Reggie Miller leg kick, but like completely gone wrong because it's like a forward scissor thing. It's very strange.
It is. I was kind of like taken aback by it because, like, you know, you're just watching, you're just noticing the misses, and then you're just like, all right, why is he missing? And you're like, oh, it's because he's scissoring his legs. Like, why is it like, why is he doing it that much?
That can't keep you balanced. Like, it's gonna throw you off. But here's the thing about the shooting, the three-point narrative that has me like a little concerned. I don't know if this means, but like, so overall, right now, I'm looking at cleaning the glass, and so they factor out like garbage time and was it end of quarter heaves. It's not that much different from his normal numbers, but just so people know where I'm getting this from. So overall, he's 38% from downtown, which is 64th percentile for point guards. So for someone who struggled so much early in his career, like really great news. But what's weird to me and what makes me wonder about the legitimacy of this is that on corner threes, he's shooting 59%. And that's 92nd percentile. And I haven't checked in a couple of weeks, but like earlier this year, someone who I don't trust at all to shoot the ball, Lance Thomas, was shooting 50% from the corners. But Moutier this year, not from the corners, and again, this is according to Cleaning the Glass, he's shooting 30% from downtown. So, and that's 17th percentile for point guards, for non-corner threes. So I'm wondering if there's any, like, if it's, I tried to find, I don't have, like, total shots in front of me, so I'm not sure how many that is in, like, actual volume. But it concerns me a little bit that he's really good, like unsustainably good, I would think, 59%. I mean, a lot of good shooters shoot super high from the corners, but 59 is like super, super high. It's 92nd percentile for point guards. I'm concerned that that's just kind of like a fluky thing over a couple months and that his real ability is more reflected in that other number.
There's probably actually a medium in between for both of those numbers. The one thing that we know about three-point shooting, which is always interesting because it's actually a very high variance shot, and it takes a lot of attempts for it to stabilize. And I believe the total is 750 shot attempts.
Yeah, I've been seeing this floating around. I think it's according to some sort of like 538 study on it, I think.
It's either 538 or nylon calculus.
Oh, nylon calculus. It's nylon calculus.
Yeah, it's okay. And it kind of makes sense where, because right now I believe Moutier has about 500 career three-point attempts.
Is that right? Okay.
And it's something along. I'm going to double-check to make sure. He has 515 three-point attempts. And for his career, he's, you know, he's not that good, you know, career-wise. You know, like 32%. So, like, this is, right now, you could say, like, this is the outlier year. This is the, you know, the hot streak during this high variance time, like, oh, he's making all the shots now. But again, like, there is, you can watch in the film, like, you can actually see, like, he has improved his, you know, his shooting release from the corner specifically, because that's when he actually has his feet set. Mm. So you can probably piece together, like, all right, if he's continuing to work on that, the corner shot may be more sustainable than, you know, a pull-up three where he's not in rhythm and not balanced.
Right.
So we still, I would say we have about, you know, over like 250, you know, three-point attempts left before we start getting an idea of who Moody is as a shooter. And then even after like that first 750, we need to wait like another 750 and be like, all right, has he actually improved as a shooter? Yeah.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense to me. Something that doesn't make as much sense are his struggles at the rim, which I want to get to in just a minute. But first, I want to remind our listeners that you guys are listening to Locked On Knicks, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. If you like what you hear, head on over to iTunes and rate us 5 stars. Once again, that's Locked On Knicks. All right, I want to talk about Emmanuel Mudiay's well-publicized struggles at the rim. He's big, he's strong, he's fast. Why do you think he's struggling at the rim? Why is it that, is he shying away from contact? Like, what's going on here?
What I think is, and that's going to probably trigger a lot of Knicks fans with some PTSD last season, but I see a little bit of Derrick Rose and how he approaches his shots at the rim, where he looks like he's trying to draw contact a little too much and like trying to draw the foul, and then in turn he's not getting a good shot at the rim that's imbalanced, and then he's like falling to the floor and he's like, where's the contact? And it's like, well, you should probably maybe focus more on the layup. So I think that could be the issue, is that he's trying to draw contact and just not getting that contact. And because he's so focused on trying to draw contact, his shooting numbers are, you know, at the rim are pretty much disastrous for someone who's that big and athletic. And so he gets to the rim so easily too, and he finishes that under like 50%, I think, last time I checked. So like, that's not good for someone who's like 6'5 and has like long arms too. So it's a very odd thing.
Yeah, because he's also got those octo arms that we like so much in Frank. I think he's listed as a 7-foot wingspan, although I don't trust wingspan numbers are like the total snake oil salesman. If you Google everyone's wingspan, it's all like 7'5". You're like, get out of here. There's no way.
I did that before because I was looking for Moody's wingspan. It was like 7 feet. I'm like, oh, wow, he's a 7-foot wingspan. And then like I Googled like someone else. I think I Googled like Neil Akila. Frank. And it was like 7 foot. And I'm like, no, it's not 7 foot. Like, it was listed at 7'1". And then it was like, I checked out like some other person. It was like Trey Burke. It's something like that. And it was like 7 foot. And I'm like, wait a second now. What is happening?
I don't know Russian Twitter bot army they're pulling these like numbers from. But
yeah, I don't know what Google's doing, but I actually think his wingspan is 6'8.5". I checked like multiple sources to like make sure.
Which is a lot different from 7. Like Frank looks like he's got that 7-foot wingspan. Like he looks.
Oh
like
yeah, Frank. It actually looks longer than like 7'1". It feels like it's like 7'5". He's just so lanky.
Yeah.
But Moody does have a larger wingspan. Like it's 6'8.5". Like that's, you know. Like, he's big and has long arms, so it's not like, it's not Frank, but still.
What you say about his Derrick Rose-ishness, it's funny you should mention that, because everyone was freaking out about that one circus layup that he had, where he kind of, like, shot it backwards over his head. And to me, like, I immediately had Nam flashbacks to Derrick Rose, and I was like, it was nice that he made that circus layup, but that kind of thing is not
sustainable. It was a poor shot selection, too.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Like, everything about it was just bad. He just lucky, and he, you know, they got, like, a pity foul out of it, and he flung it up, and it went in. Like, it wasn't a good shot at all.
That's going to get old real quick when he's missing those, you know?
Exactly.
I want to talk about his on-off numbers a little bit. You mentioned them earlier. They're hideous. We've talked about it on the show. Overall with Denver this past year, it was something like they were, like, 7.5 points worse on offense with him on the court, and, like, 6.5 points worse on defense with him on the court. But there are a couple lineups that he had that were actually positives. And you brought these up in your article. In your opinion, do you think he was just lucky enough to be in like a lineup with Jokic and he like got out of the way? Is there something there that can be like teased out for optimism for Knicks fans?
I do think so. I mean, like you mentioned, the defensive and offensive on-off numbers are dreadful. Like, his net rating this season, net on-off for Denver was 13.7.
Right.
And, like, that's...
Almost unfathomable.
Yeah, that's crazy. And you're thinking, okay, how is it this bad? But then you look at, like, some of the lineups he played the most. Like, his two best lineups, he's positive. He was a positive 11 and a positive, basically positive 11, positive 4. I'm kind of rounding up and down.
Uh-huh.
But the best lineup was with, you know, Jokic. And it's like, okay, it's a plus lineup because of Jokic. That sort of thing. Like, we right. kind of know that it's Jokic. But the other one wasn't. And I think there could be something there. And then even if we look at, because I got these numbers from Cleaning the Glass as well.
Okay.
And there is something noticeable is a lot of lineups he's playing with Will Barton. And Will Barton is also like a pretty like ball dominant player in his own right. So there's a good chance that maybe, you know, him being a little more off the ball and not, you know, using his passing ability and his vision and stuff all the time is affecting some of his play on offense. Or maybe he's like, that could play into it. Like on off data, it's a little, like, can get wonky sometimes, but sure. But I will say though, like, watching him with Neal Akila felt like a more natural fit mm-hmm. compared to Will Barton, because Neal Akila apparently, like, he looks like he'd rather be off the ball than on it. Like, that's what I felt like watching, you know, on Sunday's game. Like, he felt more comfortable, like, all right, the initial action didn't work, kick it back out to Frank, he'll run the pick and roll to do something with it. Like, it felt more natural to him than initiating the offense, where Moody, it felt more natural initiating the offense.
Yeah, I think that's right. Frank's definitely not fully comfortable doing that. And I wonder, it's sort of like a chicken-egg thing. I wonder if that, like, Hornacek seems to so rarely call an initial action for Frank where he's attacking off the dribble. He kind of always starts him off in that, like, weave set that they do at like the top mm-hmm. of the key, but I wonder if that's because he thinks it's always tough because you don't know if that's because he seems so uncomfortable, or is he not comfortable because he's not getting the minutes doing that. But it was encouraging at least to see. I mean, A, Jarrett Jack only getting 8 minutes,
yeah,
but B, him getting a lot of burn. I think there's a middle ground between Frank getting like 15 minutes and 30 and Trey Burke only getting 8, although, I don't know, what do you think about Trey Burke only getting 8 minutes last night? For me, it's almost like, I don't really expect much out of Moutier or Burke, to be honest, although, like, I'm looking for signs of optimism. Of the two of them, I feel like Moutier is a better prospect because he's younger, he hasn't gone as far with doing, like, as little, and I don't mean to say that, like, in a dickish way, because just making it to the NBA is an amazing accomplishment. You know, mm-hmm. but obviously, you know, there were much higher hopes for Burke than he's wound up, you know, delivering on so far. But what's your opinion? Like, would you be bummed if Burke didn't get a lot of look going forward? Or, like, do you think he needs to kind of almost get close to equal time with those guys? Or do you think there's kind of a clear tier between Moutier and Frank and then Burke?
I do think there's a tier. I think the one thing we need to remember about Burke is that he did flame out of the NBA, and then he had to go to the D League and rehab and everything. And it's great that the Knicks D League kind of rehabbed him because he kind of looks competent now, but that's more of like a backup role
mm-hmm.
to me. So the idea, like, you know, it'd be nice to see Burke play, but it's not, to me, it's not really the end all be all, because I see him more as a backup, whereas like you're looking at like Moutier, where you kind of see the potential. Like, it's awful as some of these numbers are, and as worrisome as the numbers, like, you kind of see, like, oh, there is potential, like, there is something there in Moutier. And then in this, you know, in this NBA now, where size and versatility are so important, like, you can throw Moutier, Neal Akina, Lee, Tim Hardaway, like, whoever it is, like, you just have like three guys, and like, they all can switch and guard 1 through 3, like, physically wise. Moutier hasn't guarded anyone, but he has the frame to do it. So, to me, I think it's better to have those guys, you know, Frank and Moody, kind of develop a rapport than
yeah.
pretty much anything else. And it doesn't matter if it's like 35 minutes, 15, 25, just play them together like they did on Sunday. I think that's probably the best way to approach it.
Now, I feel like this would be a good problem to have, but is there any concern from you over, let's say, Moody and Frank really are working out, having Tim Hardaway signed to what I think is a fine contract, even though I don't want to get into the whole argument there. But is there any concern about him who, like, I know he's shown some versatility between the two and the three, but I really do think of him as much more of a shooting guard. Do you think that could be a problem down the line? Or do you think, like, if these guys all keep developing and they're good, like, there's going to be a lot of minutes for them that will make sense and they'll be able to figure out that lineup?
You know, I think there'll be minutes for everyone. It kind of just depends. For example, like, let's just hypothetically say, like, Moutier fulfills his potential. Mm-hmm. And Frank fulfills his potential. Like, then you got to ask, like, would it be better for Hardaway to come off the bench as, like, a sixth man? Like, that's not, like, the worst thing. I mean, he would probably be technically the overpaid right. than as a sixth man. But, like, if he's still playing, like, 30 minutes, it doesn't really matter unless he wants the title of, oh, I'm a starter in the NBA. I think that's when it really becomes an issue because there's minutes and there's rotations for him.
I guess you're right. There is always that option of, like, the Manu Ginobili-esque all-star type sixth man just because of roster construction. It's just makes it a little trickier with the cap. I mean,
yeah, it does make it tricky. And then we also need to remember, like, we mentioned before, Neil Kayla's wingspan, like, it's over 7 feet. Like, mm-hmm. he could, like, just because of his wingspan, and even, like, he can play the three. Yeah. Like, he needs to get, like, he needs to get stronger, and he probably needs to work on, like, his lower body and his core to get a little faster and everything, but he could theoretically just be a shorter three, but because of his wingspan, he plays a lot larger. Like, there's times where he gets switched on the big man, he just stands up and, like, his hand, you know, is like he's, like, in their face already.
Oh, I think it's been really encouraging. A couple times he's been switched on to guys who have, like, a lot of height on him, and he's obviously not that strong yet, and he's already holding his own as, like, a scrawny-ass 19-year-old mm-hmm. in a lot of these situations. And I think he's got a frame to really put on some bulk. Like, he looks like he could be, like, yoked at some point.
No, yeah, he does. Like, it's not like, you know, Porzingis where you're, like, there's, like, a ceiling to how, like, large Porzingis can actually get. Like, right. you know, Frank looks like, oh, he can really put on, like, an extra, like, 20-some-odd pounds or whatever. It probably wouldn't hinder him at all.
He's got, like, nice, broad, boxy shoulders. It feels, like, weird to talk about people this way. But
no, but it's true, though. Like, he can theoretically be a three for, like, a wing because he has the size to do it. Like, that's not really his true ceiling, obviously. Like, his true ceiling would be, like, the lead guard at 6'5" in that length. So that's, like, where you really want, you know, Nikhil to be. But, like, if Moutier does become this promising guard that many people thought he was going to be in 2015, mm-hmm. like, it's really not the end of the world to transition Frank into, like, that secondary, like, Andre Iguodala sort of role.
Right.
Then it's like, oh, you have the secondary guy who's also giant, who can run pick and rolls, who can shoot, and he defends everyone.
I want to talk about, you had an interesting part of your article that you wrote on Moutier about the history of late bloomers in general, because, you know, Moutier is young, so people are like, oh, he's got, you know, some potential to grow. I want to get to that in just a moment, but first, I want to remind everyone that you are listening to Locked On Knicks, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. There is a podcast for every team in the NBA and the NFL, so if you're interested in any kind of basketball or football analysis for any team out there, the Knicks are playing the Sixers tonight. After that game, you might want to check out what the Sixers guys have to say about it. Check it out. They're all part of the Locked On Podcast Network. So yeah, let's talk about some late bloomers. People like to look at things optimistically when they get a new player, and Moutier is young, so there is some reason to be optimistic there. But you did have, I would say, slightly more pessimistic view on his potential for improvement based on a couple other guys who are frequently cited as late blooming point guards. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so a lot of times I, you know, if when I'm, whether it's on Twitter, Reddit, in person, like with anyone, you know, usually the counter argument, because I'm pretty pessimistic on like the actual chance of Moutier like blossoming into mm-hmm. like a very good player. And usually the counter is like, oh, he's 22 and it takes a while for players to develop. And it's like, they'll be like, look at Kyle Lowry, look at Chauncey Billups, look at Goran Dragic. He'll be like, look at Victor Oladipo right now. And it's relatively fair. Like, you know, guards can take a while mm-hmm. and it's not like a crazy concept. But then when you like, again, like you kind of look at the numbers and I can't like go back and watch like all Chauncey Billups film. Like I don't really have the time for that. But sorry, just I'm like looking at the numbers and Moutier is significantly lower in terms of just from like the basketball reference numbers. True shooting, he's the lowest. Offensive rating, lowest. PER, which, you know, it isn't like the best like metric for PER, but like it's still the lowest. Box plus minus, the lowest. Win shares, lowest. Value over replacement player, lowest. And like it's not even close either.
Yeah.
So like, and like that's the problem. So it's like, yeah, he could improve and he may very well improve, but an improvement isn't going to be that much in terms of impact because just he's not that good right now. It's not like someone like Neil Aquila who does have pretty bad numbers himself, but he's also a rookie, 19, and we kind of knew going in he was going to be raw and needs a couple of years to kind of figure out what he's going to be. Like, Moody is already in year three, and his numbers just don't even compare to many of these late bloomers either.
Yeah, it's, and I'm not trying to, like, you know, just be like a relentless downer here, but people talk about his athleticism a lot, and he is athletic, but is it fair? I feel like that's a little bit overrated. Like, I don't see, like, a speed demon, even though he's, like, a decent penetrator. Am I being a little unfair there? What do you think?
I don't think you're being unfair. Like, he's clearly athletic. I think that's the one thing, like, that's something the Knicks haven't had in a very long time, but I don't know if he has a faster, you know, first step than Derrick Rose now. Like, I'm not entirely sure. He does have a good first step, but, like, when they say, like, you know, freak athlete, like, I kind of think, like, Russell Westbrook and, like, Victor Oladipo, who was torching the Knicks, you know, on Sunday, and you're like, wow, that guy's an athlete. Like, Emmanuel Mudiay isn't Victor Oladipo.
That's kind of what I'm saying. Like, I feel like he's got, like, an above-average first step, but not anywhere close to being like, damn! Like, I'm not, like, blown away by his athleticism. Like, it's good. But I almost feel like Frank is faster than him. Like, I'd like to see them in a 100-yard dash, like, straight away. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, that would be pretty interesting, because a lot of people, like, knock Neil Aquina for his athleticism. And it's kind of fair to an extent. Like, he isn't the most athletic player, but a lot of his issues, I think, just from watching him, I can't really, like, quantify it, but I think it has more to do with his ball handling, like his lack of confidence in his dribble that makes his first step not good.
I kind of agree, because, like, every once in a while, I've seen it more and more recently, you're like, whoa, like, he got into the lane quick, but, like, he seems a little out of control. He's not, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I see it. Like, he can't. It's like he's like, oh, he can't blow by people. Like, he's blown by people. Like, I think when he's got some feels burst. Confident.
Yeah.
It just, that's kind of how I see. But I do think Moody is more athletic than Neil Aquina. But I don't think it's, like, above and away, like, noticeable.
Right. Yeah. Okay. If you had to pick, like, one thing that you think is most likely he could improve on, like, what do you think that might be?
That's a tough question.
It's nothing. It's nothing. I can tell by that sigh.
Yeah, it's... If I were to pick one thing, I do think depending on, like, the coaching staff, I do think ball control is something that he could, you know, improve upon. Because if he's... I feel like if he's playing with another guard, like Hardaway and Frank, and even when, you know, hopefully, you know, Porzingis comes back next year, like, he has guys, like, he can pass to and he can, like, cut down on turnovers. I do think that's something he can improve upon by just tightening up his handle.
Right.
But, like, that's it. Like, I'm still very, very skeptical on, like, him being able to finish at the rim. Like, that's just something I don't know how you really improve on that other than, yeah, like, I don't even know how you improve on that. And defense is going to be very, very difficult to improve. Because a lot of it's, like, IQ turn for stuff with, like, IQ. And that's really difficult to teach. Because I think I think it was Cleaning the Glass who did the article on Porzingis with his decision-making out of the post. Mm-hmm. And Ben Falk was like, decision-making out of the post is really hard to improve upon. And he's right. Like, knowing when to pass and knowing when to do something is tough. So, yeah. Like, I just wouldn't be really banking on.
And then in contrast, KP on a lot of plays has pretty great defensive awareness and instinct. Not always. There's things he can improve on, but I feel like he's a little bit more naturally gifted there than in, like, passing out of the double team, although maybe you disagree.
No, I'm with you with that. Like, you can kind of see, like, kind of like the instinct. You kind of just, you look at him and go, all right, he has the instinct. So you can say Porzingis needs to, like, focus on standing more upright. Well, that's relatively simple to correct if he puts the time. Like, he can do that, work on verticality. But, like, you can't improve on, like, when do I actually go for the block? Like, that's kind of instinctual. You just kind of have a feeling. You just kind
of
know.
And that's one of those things that's the hardest to scout. You hear about it almost, I feel like, more often in football where there's, like, such this emphasis on the combine. It's like, oh, they can bench 900 pounds 17 times in a row, and their, like, standing broad jump is 9 feet. And then it's like, oh, but they don't know how to play football. you know.
Yeah.
And there's a similar thing that happens with NBA players, because you do need a baseline of athleticism. So people are like, oh, this guy's a great athlete. Hopefully we can develop the player. And that's like the hardest part, is finding the guy who has both of those things. And I would say the hardest to improve on is to just like that feel for the game. And like that's really what distinguishes the greats from people who are like pretty good.
It's why I'm higher on someone like Neil Akina than Moutier.
Yes.
Because Neil Akina kind of has that feel. You kind of watch him on the pick and roll, and he just kind of knows when to pass, and he kind of knows when to do these things. You go, okay, like, he can put it together. He just needs to get stronger in his core and work on his handles.
Yeah, I love like his that, vision like, so much. His handles terrify me.
Oh, yeah, like, it's just, it gets, like, loose and wonky, and then, like, he doesn't really drive, and then when he tries to drive, he gets caught up, and then he passes. When he isn't supposed to pass, he's supposed to shoot. It's very tricky with him, but you can kind of see, like, he has the feel. So you're just like, okay, like, he can improve his shot a little more. Like, he can improve his handles a little more. Like, that's not too difficult. But if you're saying someone like, oh, he needs to improve his passing vision as a point guard, then you're like, you're at a loss for words. Like, I don't even know how you teach something like that.
Right. It is just, I mean, it can come with being more comfortable with the other stuff, because then you're not thinking about, like, your handles and stuff as much. But you're right. I mean, even someone who struggles with that as much as Frank has, his vision is fantastic. Like, he finds these seams sometimes. You're like, whoa, like, how did he do that? And, like, he's got great soft touch on his passes. So, like, if, like, he has all those instincts on both sides of the ball. I mean, although, I guess you could say he needs to develop the offensive instincts a lot more in terms of, like, when to pass and shoot. But I also think that's so much of, like, just wanting to, like, play good basketball and be, like, a deferential, like, point guard that sets up your teammates. It feels figure-outable.
No, I agree. I think it's just more of just, maybe even the coaching staff, like, just being, it's okay to shoot, like, you know, 2 for 8, like, just take a good shot.
Yeah.
Like, that just needs to be instilled into his head. I think that's correctable, I would say.
Yeah, and hopefully they just leave him in now to work through some of those bumps and bruises. People were talking about, you know, oh, well, like, he must be on a minutes restriction. He's only playing 20 minutes a night. He mentioned his knee. But now he played 30 the other night. The Knicks are they're driving me crazy, same as always. It's like, if he was on a minutes restriction, shouldn't they have just said it? Like, there's no shame in that anymore. Like, the Sixers do it all the time. Like, lots of teams do it when a player is struggling. It's just so bizarre to me.
I mean, when it comes to trying to figure out logic with this team and front office management, it's almost like don't. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
It's like,
because they're like, we need the whole players accountable for stuff. And then you see Jarrett Jack, like, continually blow pick and roll coverages, but he's still out there.
Right.
And then it's like, oh, we need to focus on youth and Willie Hernangómez is part of the future. And then you trade him for 2 second round picks. And then you're like, oh, okay.
And it's just funny because, like,
okay.
It's not even – some of these moves I don't even mind. It's that there's no explanation for them. Like, I'm not a big Billy guy. I do think he's kind of like an old-school center and has like a ceiling as like a decent backup. I don't even mind moving him. But if you're saying it's youth and you're saying he's part of your core and then you trade him, but you're not explaining why you traded him, I know there's like some tact that goes into it where you don't want to like shit on people. But you could like be a dick without being a dick and be like, we wanted to look at someone with a little bit more like lateral quickness. You know, you can like say these things. It's a business. You're spending millions of dollars on these guys. Like, you have to not be afraid to like hurt feelings a little bit. And like, I don't think they're gaining any competitive advantage by being secretive with the media. So it's like, it is still, they're not the same like complete dysfunctional clown town circus, but they still are not run the way like I would like to see like overall, I think. I don't know.
No, I'm agreeing with you. It's like they do a lot of like the lip service that, you know, the fans want to hear, like, oh no, they're doing this, oh they're doing that. And that's like, are they actually doing this? It's like, I don't know. I don't think so.
It's such an improvement to like not get rid of a first round pick, you know, so it's already like, oh my God, like they're doing so much better, but there's so much farther they could go to be a more well run organization. I'd like to close our discussion of Emmanuel Moutier by, every once in a while we do this sort of question. It's been a little bit, but I'm wondering if you could compare Emmanuel Moutier to a character from a favorite TV show or movie. Is that something that you feel equipped to do? We can talk it out if you need to.
Yeah, no, I've thought about this. If you don't mind me peeking behind the curtain a little bit, you did mention like this may be a topic.
You ruined the illusion, Drew.
Sorry. But
It's all right. You only hurt yourself. If it looked like it was off the top of your dome, that would have been even more impressive. That's all I'm saying.
Probably, but it was something I was thinking about all day. Because no, it just I wanted to tell the story because like I'm at I have work to do for like work, and I'm thinking like, who is Emmanuel Moody? Like, is he someone from The Wire? Like, no. It's like, is he someone from like Community? And I'm like, no, that doesn't make any sense. And I'm like, I'm trying to come up with something, and I think I got it.
Okay, I'm excited. Okay.
I think, and I'm going to tie in Frank as well, I think Emmanuel Mudiay is Marty McFly.
Oh my god.
So,
I need to be talked through this. Right now,
yeah, so you may be thinking, like, Marty McFly is an amazing character. He's awesome. Marty McFly is awesome, but we do need to remember some, like, context of Marty McFly. See, Marty McFly, for the most part, you know, in school, like, he was a slacker. He was an underachiever. He had a band that couldn't even make the talent show. He didn't do good in school. Like, he was just...
He blew up Doc's amp, like, immediately.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he just... He wasn't living up to his potential. And he had a home life that... Where, like, his parents didn't even, like, care about him.
It's true.
And that reminds me a lot of, like, Denver. They just kind of threw him to the curb. Like, oh, we have Jamal Murray. Like, we don't need you, Emmanuel. Go sit on the bench. So
they haven't tapped into him. They haven't tapped into his potential.
Exactly. So what they did was, in order for Marty to live up to his potential, he needed a cataclysmic change of events. He needed a change of scenery. And that change of scenery was traveling back to 1955 in the DeLorean.
Into the Knicks offense.
Into the Knicks offense. And this is where Frank comes into play, because Frank is George McFly.
Wow.
So yes. So what do we know about George McFly in 1955?
Huge dork.
He was shy, timid, wasn't really living up to his potential either. And Marty does. He gives him a little kick in the ass. He tells him, you need to be more aggressive. He makes pretend he's Darth Vader, and he's playing metal music, and he's telling him to hit Biff in the mouth.
Yes.
And then, right? And then George eventually does it. And that's what Neil Akilah was doing in that game yesterday. He was taking it to the rim. He was taking shots without a problem. Like, he needed that little kick. He needed that spark. And that spark was his son.
Oh, my God. That is beautiful. I'm glad you thought about that all day.
I did. I thought I there was a time I'm like on my lunch break. I'm like, no, I'm thinking this through. And I'm like, I'm going to prepare it, and it's going to be wonderful.
Dropped a bomb on me. I'm still recovering from that one. True. This has been wonderful. It's your first time on the show. A big moment in everyone's lives.
It is.
Yeah.
Maybe the most important.
Yeah. I mean, people have said, they're like, the birth of my first child like is up there, and then my first appearance on Locked On Knicks is like roughly tied in terms of, you know.
Yeah, it's something around.
It's
1A or 1B.
Yeah. Like it's something like that. But was really great talking to you. If people want to find more of your work or more of you, where should they go? Is there anything you want to plug?
Yeah, I'll plug some stuff. Where you're going to find me mainly is Twitter at the good old handle Scooter Toots. Cracks me up every time I say it because you don't know. Like it's just a funny term.
Scooter Toots.
But it also, yeah.
How do you spell that for them? Spell it for them.
Scooter as in Scooter, mm-hmm. Then Toots, Toots.
As in Toots and the Maytals.
Yep, exactly. But you can find most of my work and then all the work I do with a great group of folks at the website Holyfield. And it's holyfield.co.com. Oh. Trying to be a little trendy without it.
I like that.
And yeah, and we're a kind of like, you know, just like an emerging startup kind of sports and culture website. And there's tons of great stuff for the NBA, NFL, culture and stuff. Like we do, I think we do tons of great work. We've done, there's one thing in the article I didn't want, like I mentioned, there's something called HPPR.
Mm-hmm.
If you you caught it, like that's a passing metric that we kind of came up with, but, you know, doing all the advanced analytics stuff. So we'll do that from time to time. We have a nice little like monthly movie series where we write about some of our favorite movies for like a theme of the month.
Oh.
It's always cool. Last month is this month. So February. Oh man, I'm losing track. February we did like movies that took place in Philadelphia and Boston in honor of the Super Bowl.
Oh.
So we just Yeah, so I talked about one of the best movies, National Treasure.
I have seen that on an airplane, so I'm vaguely familiar with it.
Oh, you need to watch it more. You need to watch it on, like, the big screen. I mean, this... It's perfect. It's, like, perfect Nick Cage.
You're a big Nick Cage guy? That's fair.
Yeah, I mean, he just has all these entertaining movies.
He's kind of hard.
He's a national treasure.
He is a national treasure. I'm a big fan of Bad Lieutenant.
I have not seen that.
You should see it. It's, like, it's much darker and less silly in a National Treasure, but it is completely unhinged Cage. It's Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans. It's a remake of a movie that, like, Harvey Keitel was in as, like, the original Bad Lieutenant. But it is excellent and insane, and I highly recommend it if you're a Nick Cage fan.
Is it, like, Face Off and Con Air insane?
Not that level, but, like, as close as it could be without literally trading faces with another person.
I mean, Face Off is... I mean, it's brilliant in, like, the most absurd way possible.
Yes. They take an idea as far as it can possibly go.
Yeah, that should be, like, the plug is not only go visit Holyfield, like, just watch Face Off. just go watch Face Off. Oh, like, after you're done listening to the podcast, after you're done reading a couple of articles, go watch Face Off.
And no movie was, like, more of its time. I don't even remember when it was released, but it just was so that year. Like, it made so much sense.
Yeah, what was it? It was, like, mid to late 90s.
I want to say it was, like, 99 was my first thought. Now I'm going to look this
up. I'm thinking 96, but it's something in that range.
97. Right?
97, okay. Like, it's perfect, like, 90s.
Yeah, it's the most 97. Oh, my God. Yeah, Face Off. All right, that was great. Thanks for joining us, Drew.
Thank you, James.
That was great. I had a great time talking to Drew. I'm sure he'll always remember his first time on the Locked On Knicks podcast. That's it for us for today. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you've got a moment, do a bunch of stuff for us. Rate us on iTunes. Subscribe to the podcast. Tell your friends about the podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Locked On Knicks. You can follow me personally on Twitter at NBA Injury Report. Be chill to each other and join us tomorrow. We got a couple of great guests coming up tomorrow. Some surprises for another episode of Locked On Knicks. Peace!